Hey, welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and how's it going this week, Steve?
I am good, John. How are you?
Good, good. You making money?
I've made some money, actually. Yeah, random, but I have.
Oh, wow. You're that one guy, I guess. Huh?
Good I'm for the you. One guy with the account, yes. Somehow so
that one guy we can hate on, I guess. That's yes. What I meant. All right, let's get started. So, Steve, have you heard of this new app called Clubhouse? It's like exclusive for VCs.
I have not gotten my invitation, no.
No, not yet. Yeah. So what do you do when everyone's suffering and there's no money out there and you're a VC trying to help out the world? Trying to make the world a better place, I should say.
You create an app?
You create an app just for you and your rich buddies to share.
When what exactly is being shared in this app?
Yeah, it's just a way for VCs to connect, a social media app with each other during this quarantine. You have to get an invitation.
I got to say, the name could not be worse. Clubhouse, it just denotes all these, you know, all these notions about exclusivity and white shoe law firms and the good old white boys club that is VC.
It does have a bit of that private club kind of feel already. You know, the funny thing about this is Mark Andreessen writes this in his blog. He mentions about, we should be building things to reboot the American dream. You know, infrastructure, we should be building the Hyperloop and new high-tech nuclear reactors, and instead they come out with yet another app, another social media app, because to be even more exclusive, can't just make a little room or a group in Facebook or anything.
You have to have an
exclusive app. Yeah. So I thought that was kind of funny with everything else going on. You know, this is getting some engineering time. So did you see the latest episode of Billions? By the way,
I do not watch Billions. Do you?
Yeah. I've just been binging it and catching up. It's kind of fun, soap opera, finance, hedge fund thing. But it's kind of funny because they bring up Bitcoin mining, and the teenage son at a fancy prep school ends up blowing out the electricity in his town, trying to create all these mining rigs connected to the grid there.
So they're finally addressing Bitcoin and mining and the strain on energy resources maybe 3-4 years late? That's awesome.
A little bit late. It's kind of funny. The first episode for the season, they had like they were busting a bunch of miners, like crypto miners, not like the teenage son. Mm-hmm. And then now the kid can. And I have to say that Bobby Axelrod, the main character, is doing a terrible job as a parent. Instead of busting the kid, he crushes the headmaster of the school so that his kid doesn't get in trouble. So what kind of lesson is he teaching his kid there?
That seems like the wrong approach. Come on, Axelrod.
Yeah. Well, actually, his lesson is that the rich crush everyone and everything in their way. And that's what he wants his kid to learn, actually. But there is stuff going on in the world of cryptocurrency. And, you know, it's been a while since we've talked about it. And I mean in real life, not on the show Billions. And I wanted to go over, just a few updates on what's been going on out there. So Bitcoin actually had a significant event lately. They have what's called the Bitcoin halving. Halving.
I've heard halving, the halvening is one that I've heard as well. The great halving.
Halving. Yeah. It's not have, you have it. It's in half. So you get 6.25 Bitcoins instead of 12.5 Bitcoins for your mining every 10 minutes. So they're reducing the amount of cryptocurrency that you're getting rewarded.
So they're doing this so that we can eventually get to 21 million Bitcoin in the year 2030 something. Is that the time horizon here?
Oh, no. It's like 100 years away. It's 21 something.
Oh, wow. Very ambitious.
You still have time to jump in. There's still time in like season 15 of Billions to still talk about it.
Season 15.
There's still cryptocurrencies or Bitcoin will still be mining and all that. So this is reducing the amount that you get compensated. So if you thought it was already hard and expensive electricity-wise to mine Bitcoin, it's even worse now.
So what you're saying is that it may not be worth maybe blowing up the electrical grid in your small town, like in the show Billions?
Only if your dad is an actual billionaire, then maybe you can get away with that. But otherwise, not so much. So part of the scheme is that eventually all of the compensation will come from transaction costs. So you'll still get compensated, but it won't be from new Bitcoin. It'll be from some tiny percent of, hopefully tiny percent of all the transactions going across the network. But until that time, I think most of it is from the new mining that's happening. So you get, according to prices 3 days ago, the halving means that you get $58,000 less for every block that's mined now. So a little bit of a pay cut for the crypto miners out there, for Bitcoin, I should say.
So a question on this, how many, any sense about how the distribution is for Bitcoin miners? Is it mostly big operations or just very a very fragmented market? What does that look like? Do we even know? Can we even tell?
Yeah. And there's a way you can find out where it is that people are doing crypto mining, because it's got to be where the electricity is very cheap. So there's some places. Iceland, yes, yeah, right. I never thought this would be the case anywhere, but there are some places that produce just too much electricity. One of the examples of this is Sichuan, and Sichuan has a major hydroelectric dam, and they have more electricity than they could possibly feed to the surrounding area. So instead of just drawing off that electricity, they do crypto mining. So it's excess electricity getting converted into cryptocurrencies. And that's why some of the main places, along with Iceland, which has had the same problem, Iceland, because of their geothermal electricity, has been smelting aluminum in the past so that they could use the electricity to actually produce something. So they're actually exporting aluminum, smelting bauxite ore from other places, creating this aluminum, sending it back out all over the world. So they're exporting aluminum, which represents their excess electricity. And the same thing is happening in China for hydropower. It's a plurality. I don't know if it's a majority of the Bitcoin mining is taking place in three main cities, Xinjiang, Sichuan, and Inner Mongolia.
So I thought that Bitcoin mining was illegal or frowned upon in China. That's not the case?
I saw that you can't really buy stuff or use it in the banks, and wallets are a big problem there. So actually, I'm not sure. Yeah, this mining is all happening in China. Maybe it's the central government that's just getting it, keeping it, and profiting. I'm not sure what's going on with that.
So the mining is maybe quasi-legal, but I'm guessing the transacting is not legal, which is interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely frowned upon, at least until they work on their own cryptocurrency, if they can find a way to profit from it. You know, not a lot goes on of any size in China without the top-level approval.
That certainly does not.
So I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah, but that's interesting, and I'm not sure how they convert it or use it then once they mine it, or just convert it and get rid of it.
Interesting.
But so they can tell, based on geotagging the locations they're mining, where this is happening. So it's definitely in China, but it might be some quasi-legal kind of process that's going on there. So Bitcoin mining is definitely going to stay in those places where there's an excess of energy supply, because nobody else will be able to make it work, make the economics work. It's just going to be too energy intensive, and the reward is less than it was before.
Although with oil prices the way they are now, I don't know. Maybe there's some sort of confluence that we can build to here by having very cheap oil and then maybe less expensive but still pretty profitable Bitcoin. Boom, arbitrage.
Yeah, you saw oil going negative for a little bit there on the futures market.
Yep.
So if they're paying you to have the oil, you're just going to burn it into Bitcoin, sure. I don't think that's a very sustainable model, though.
It's not.
It's going to be these places where it's like virtually free excess electricity. Yeah. So the bottom line with the halving is, it's going to go to where the energy is produced very, very cheaply, if not free excess electricity from existing processes. One of the other effects is that the Bitcoin price should get driven up as well. There's less being produced. There's more relative scarcity because of that. That's going to push that price up. And that's traditionally what's happened before in other Bitcoin halving events.
It's interesting to note here that Ether, which closely tracks Bitcoin in terms of price, has gone up 65% so far this year, which is pretty crazy. And the biggest spike really came after March 13th. So maybe when the shelter in place was being put in a lot of states, maybe people flew from the dollar to more esoteric instruments like Ether and Bitcoin.
There was a flight to quality away from.
I wouldn't call that quality. There's a flight to something. There's a flight to something there.
Quality of something that's not getting hyperinflated. Like, you know, of course, trillions of dollars, I should say, of U.S. dollars flooding the market. It's going to push inflation and prices up in general. But we'll see what happens. So separately, what do eBay, MasterCard, Stripe, Visa and PayPal have in common?
Good websites.
Good websites. Well, yeah, that's true. But also, they are former members of the Libra Association.
Oh, my.
The Facebook cryptocurrency.
That's still a thing?
Yeah. They have better people that were formerly part of their ecosystem than you'll ever have. So there. So some big updates for them, and we haven't talked about them for a while, but so let's get caught up with this cryptocurrency as well. They just hired Stuart Levy as their CEO. He'll be the first CEO for Libra, and actually just announced this week is Robert Werner. He'll be head of regulatory financial crime compliance and enforcement experience. And this guy has the chops. So Libra is getting some very experienced people at the top of the house there. He was formerly director of FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, mm-hmm. and the director of OFAC.
So he comes from a more government regulatory background than a typical, you know, product or crypto bro background, right?
He's not a crypto bro, that's for sure. He's definitely a compliance expert. I mean, he was director of OFAC. He was also the senior counsel for the undersecretary of the Treasury Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. So this guy's been around for a bit. So they're getting some solid hires over there at Libra, getting ready to make some big moves, I guess. Also, Visa has just said that they may consider coming back to the Libra Association. They said the CEO in a recent interview said that they decided not to join the association because they were spooked by the regulatory blowback that they were seeing for the project.
Yeah, this was not getting any love from any of the regulators. I recall there might have been even some sort of congressional action against Libra or calls to do so as well. So I wonder what's making them actually want to go back now and try to reignite all those issues as well. We'll see.
Yeah, I think Libra has been addressing some of their concerns. It sounds like they're getting away more from creating their own currency and more towards creating a wallet that'll be able to manage stable coins that are tied to existing fiat currencies. So then it's less of a break from the current system that they can get behind, and maybe there'd be less pushback also.
That seems like a big reduction in scope that... You know, you go from ambitions to basically dominate the global financial system to now just say, hey, we're going to have a nice little wallet for you here.
Yeah. I think that's still, it sounds like it's still a big project. They're going to have like the fiat currencies for dozens of currencies all handled in one wallet. So maybe it just gets rid of the whole transaction costs and currency exchange issues. I'm not sure. These are kind of new announcements that are going out there. But the Calibra wallet is what they're calling it. But they must have big plans to have these big hires and attracting these substantial kind of people that they're bringing on, and even Visa considering jumping back in.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a bit skeptical about Libra and Calibra as well, but I'm curious as to where this ends up, you know, 2 years from now when the dust settles on this. Because I do think that there's a need for a multi-currency wallet that supports fiat currency. Sure, that makes sense. I don't know whether Facebook is the right player to kind of lead this effort, but now that Shopify's into it and the other in that Visa's getting back into it, we may see something actually come to fruition, which will be pretty interesting.
Yeah. So what else is going on in the world of fintech?
Well, CB Insights recently released their Q1 2020 Global Fintech Funding Report, and it is brutal, my friend, as you can imagine.
Yeah, I love those decks.
Yeah, it's basically, you know, it summarizes really sort of the you know, Q1 is, of course, January through March, and I think that it summarizes the effects of COVID-19 on VCs and on fintech funding. So a few things to kind of pull out from here is that, of course, this again covers the period through the end of March, which wasn't even the entirety of, or which I guess was sort of the beginning stages of the COVID-19 crisis of this current pandemic. But it kind of highlights both the wins and fails for fintech in a really interesting way. Funding fell something like 40% across the board. There are many fewer deals. There also seemed to be a lot of more deals at the later stage companies and fewer sort of riskier bets at the seed and A stage as well, which makes sense, right? If you're a VC or some sort of investor, you don't want to go with the risky stuff now. You want to kind of place your bets on either capitalizing or allowing the companies that actually have a chance to survive this pandemic to grow more, right? So this is really borne out by this report.
Yeah, that's what we've been hearing, right? That they would stick with keeping their existing investments alive before starting a whole new commitment and rounds of financing. But this kind of reminds me of that deck. I think it was from WeWork, where it had the Valley of Coronavirus. Is that what it was called?
Oh my God, I love that deck so much. With the unicorns falling inside of it and then eventually pulling their way out. It's like a four slide sequence. If you haven't seen it, please look up the SoftBank slides. They're amazing to behold.
Oh, right. It was SoftBank's overall report of their investments, yeah?
Yes. They actually, I think they had maybe the worst quarter for any company in the history of the world. They lost something like $17 billion, which is, even Uber is sort of laughing at those losses.
Oh, man. Yeah. Boy, poor Uber, too. They've just laid off 3,000 people and, you know, on top of a few thousand before that.
Yeah.
So it's looking a bit grim. And yeah, you can see that in the CB Insights report as well. The bar chart showing the investments and the expected total for 2020 is just a steep dive straight down. Yeah, the other thing I like about this deck is, actually these decks every quarter, is that they dive into some trends and new things that are going on. And in this one, they point out some really big financing rounds that are happening on the challenger bank front. Revolut raised $500 million in February to expand their U.S. rollout. Chime raised $200 million in March. And N26 just raised $100 million in April. I would say that they had excellent timing to raise this money just before this COVID-19 shutdown started to happen.
It makes sense, especially if you think of, you know, all the news stories we hear here in the Bay Area about companies laying off staff or just going under in this crisis, right? It makes sense. One other really interesting thing about this is that there's been there's been a large influx of cash also into loan servicing and debt collection companies as well. So basically the investors are kind of seeing that there will be massive defaults in the future, you know, 3, 6 to 12 months from now. And they're looking to invest to, again, bolster those companies' balance sheets as well so they can be poised to really take on more market share in the future, which is a really smart play, I think.
Yeah. I thought that was kind of funny that they already, I mean, obviously the report was put together well into April, early May when they knew, you know, what was going to happen.
Yep.
But yeah, some of these companies, True Accord, works with debtors to negotiate flexible payments. And there's another one called Haven that does payment modeling for lenders so they can anticipate a little bit better. But yeah, it's funny that they're able to target and kind of clarify what's going on in the market so well.
Yeah, it's interesting because there seems to be some pullback in some fake fintech subsectors, like maybe RegTech, but it seems like the money, you know, whatever money is actually being spent is being spent on things like debt collection, services for restaurants or for SMB/SMEs. It's nice to see the money going to places where it's the most needed, I think.
Yeah, for sure. So they say that $6.1 billion was invested in Q1 of 2020. And I'm going to make a wild prediction that that's going to be the best investing quarter for the year.
We may see a rise in Q4, you know, depending on whether we have a vaccine, whether we've really crossed the curve, but who knows, right? It's impossible to tell. But I wouldn't quite say that it's going to be the best one for the year so far. Yeah, I'm very optimistic.
Well, you are very optimistic. I don't know. The economy is going to is already been hit very hard. Employment rate's going to just be death for a lot of these companies, except for like the ones we mentioned, like focus on areas that are specifically helping in a down economy or have some kind of relevant to a down economy. I wonder if the same thing will happen as did during like the dot-com bust before, where a VC will look at their portfolio and try to merge struggling companies. And the way they used to describe that is trying to tie two stones together to see if they'll float.
That old adage, yeah, yeah.
And now it's time for our final bites, where we take a look at a number and the interesting story behind it.
I have a number, John, that's pretty cool. Or actually pretty sad, if you think about it. My number is $100,000.
Why are we talking about your salary?
No, it's actually, this is the, if your salary is 100K in the US, you have a 40% chance of being able to work from home. However, if your salary is $25,000 or less, you have a 5% chance of being able to work from home.
Yeah, unfortunately, this crisis falls more heavily on those less able to afford it.
Yep.
Well, my final bite is $1.7 billion. Not
is that
my
your salary?
Salary. No, not at all. But that's the amount that one-time cryptocurrency TON, T-O-N, the Telegram Open Network was trying to raise in its ICO. And the reason I bring this up is it's a lot like Libra. They put out their white paper. They were trying to create something that they could use through their messaging app.
Yep.
And on May 12th of this year, it's announced that Telegram would no longer operate TON, or the Telegram Open Network, any longer, or try to develop that cryptocurrency any further. And that was after years. I'll tell you why. It's called the SEC. That's filed an emergency action, temporary restraining orders, ongoing legal battles, and it was just too much. So Telegram's completely given up on their cryptocurrency. If you hadn't heard yet, your crypto wallet with TON is not worth very much anymore. So maybe not the same fate as Libra, but since they're definitely going to try to address their regulatory compliance hurdle's too low. I'm going to say their 20-foot wall of compliance and legal border to cross. But this is what happened to a predecessor to Libra. And didn't end up well.
Oh, that's just awful news.
Needless to say, that $1.7 billion ICO was never raised, and the SEC got involved at that point. So
I have a challenge for our listeners. If you've come across a successful non-fraudulent ICO, please send me a note.
A non-fraudulent ICO. Okay, so nobody can email us from jail.
Yeah.
Yes.
From SEC jail, yes.
So not like a failed project, like a failed Kickstarter where they got the money and just couldn't get around to, or underestimated how much it would cost or anything.
None of that nonsense.
So it has to be non-fraudulent and successful.
Non-fraudulent, successful, and still alive. If you've come across that, send us a note, and I'll send you a nice treat, I promise.
Yeah, send that to info@fintechnewscast.com. Yeah, you've got me curious now. All right, that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in FinTech news, and thanks for listening.
Stay safe. See you later.